What's going on, guys? Welcome to another episode of Healthspin Academy. I'm your host, Craig Shearhart, and joining me today is my special guest, E.C. Sinkowski, who is a nutrition expert. She started her academic career with a Bachelor of Science in Biological Resource Engineering, another bioengineer. Thumbs up to that, from University of Maryland. Went on to get a master's in natural resource sciences from University of Maryland, and then a master's in human nutrition and functional medicine from University of Western States. She's become a licensed dietitian. She's a certified nutrition specialist. She's a CrossFit level 4 coach, and she's the founder of the 800 gram challenge and Optimize Me Nutrition. So today is about all things nutrition and stuff that we should and shouldn't be putting in our body. EC, thanks for joining me today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on and that intro.
Oh, cool. Cheers. My pleasure. So I want to start this off with how nutrition kind of came into your life. Obviously, you've been eating your whole life. When did that become something you wanted to coach people on?
You know, I probably would have to credit CrossFit with doing that. It's certainly, cool. I was always active. I was always interested in it. I actually did macros before I knew what macros was, even before CrossFit in college. Oh, wow. And stuff. Yeah. Did all manually by hand and following the USDA pyramid and stuff like that. So nutrition was certainly part of my life, but I think at CrossFit, it was the foundation of the pyramid. You know, yeah. It was this idea that when you're chasing athletics, you really want to have both diet and exercise working for you. You don't want to focus on one or the other.
For sure.
And so it was always part of our content there. And ultimately that's what led to me starting the master's in nutrition is I needed to do continuing education credits, for some requirements for CrossFit. And so I ended up starting a master's and didn't really think about starting my own business or becoming a nutritionist. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, things changed along the way. So I think I'd credit CrossFit with really kind of the interest and focus on nutrition. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. It's a good foundation. I like the whole fitness in 100 words. It kind of hits the nail on the head. And I think just like it makes sense. Paleolithic kind of principles is kind of at the root there. Paleolithic kind of lifting principles. It's all along the spectrum of functional fitness and medicine, I guess. So I love that. And at some point you came up with this 800 gram challenge and I love this. We did this with my gym as a big hit. And I feel like more people could use more veggies and fruits in their diet. It's kind of like that way of keeping people accountable. How did you first come up with this?
Yeah. You know, I actually had a friend, Heather Bergeron. So a lot of people know her in the kind of the space. We were close cause I used to live up in Boston, and I just remember her saying one day, she was like, you know, you can never eat enough vegetables, right? And it was sort of like this idea of like, well, that's interesting. Can you in the sense of, am I worried about too many vegetables, but where's sort of this number at which we know, you know, we're eating enough. Mm-hmm. And of course, then working for CrossFit and always having this idea on measurement and being able to have data on stuff, that was always kind of brewing in my mind. Mm-hmm. And so as nutrition became more of interest to me, it kind of was this idea of like, well, how do we measure quality in the diet? How do we know when we say we're eating clean, even though I really don't like that word?
Yeah.
And so it was during my master's, I happened to come across a study that was looking at fruit and vegetable consumption relative to health outcomes. And I had been already playing with this idea of like, how do you measure quality? And they were just basically saying, okay, how many fruits and veggies do people eat? And then what happens to them in terms of their health? And they measured things like cardiovascular disease, cancer, stroke, all-cause mortality, you know, things we care about. Yeah. And what they found was that, what they found was that at the 800 gram volume of fruits and veggies, the risk of all of those went down. Hmm. And so of course, with this sort of this background of me thinking about, well, how do I measure quality? I was like, that's interesting. What about if I try to eat 800 grams of fruits and vegetables each day, no other rules and restrictions in my diet, and see what happens? And so, of course, this is how the 800 gram challenge was born. Now, I do like to point out, you know, I'm not new in the sense of there's plenty of people before me who suggested to eat fruits and vegetables. there's plenty of other recommendations out there. The USDA, for example, has given serving sizes and recommendations forever.
Right.
I think what's really unique about the 800 gram challenge and why people have kind of liked it, so it seems, and people have joined on it, which is great to see, is it kind of just simplifies all these rules, right? Yeah. I don't tell you which fruits and veggies you have to eat. I leave it up to you. It doesn't matter if they're cooked, canned, frozen, or fresh. It doesn't have to be this many number of vegetables and this many number of pieces of fruit. It's just like people have such busy lives and preferences. If we just give them a little autonomy, they're going to figure it out.
Yeah. They can kind of follow their preferences and just kind of let the, and I think that's part of the flexibility is what makes it great too, because like our cravings, there's usually some kind of root cause for our cravings, whether it's our gut biome or what have you. And it's so it is kind of cool to let people kind of chase their own version of it.
And so that's sort of, to be honest, when I first kind of came up with the idea, I actually did 6 months of testing, just do it myself to collect data on it. What does this look like? And do I have certain rules? Do I allow olives? What about beans? Yeah. You know, because that's not what the study was doing. The study was looking at like risk reduction. They weren't trying to come up with a diet.
Right.
And so I actually play with it. What are the calories? What are the macros? What are the fiber? How does this change? You know, to really kind of play it backwards and forwards to see how it was. And it's like a lot of these things that we worry about really do shake out over weeks when we just let people have a little autonomy and freedom.
Yeah. Yeah. Fair enough. Yeah. It's a cool concept. So, and I think you hear kind of, we're going to talk a little bit more about like maybe whether there's an upper limit. And I don't know, we both read the carnivore code. So I'm curious to hear your take on that.
Yeah.
And so there may be an upper limit there, but there's also like a minimum kind of protein. There's also like different body sizes. So how do you recommend people navigate customizing this to their own kind of specific needs?
Yeah. Yeah. I do consider the 800 gram number a baseline from which larger and more active people may scale up. I'm certainly not naive enough to think it's the only number at which somebody can be healthy. I just think it's very realistic. And there's lots of different reasons why I think it's realistic. A couple of them I'll mention. One, from a calorie standpoint, it usually is 400 to 500 calories. So it's only about 25% of most people's daily needs.
Yeah.
From a volume perspective, it fits on a single plate. You know, typically we eat 3 plates a day. So, I mean, there's that.
Yeah.
And then I think the other thing that's really important to point out is this wasn't something that I just tried and was like, oh, wow, my diet's great. I'm going to recommend my diet to everybody.
Yeah.
This number came from a meta-analysis of looking at 95 different studies. There was no way this huge cross-section of people was, you know, all 6-foot active CrossFitters.
Yeah.
You know,
they're just it's not how research works.
Right. I mean, they're just kind of taking these cross-section studies of lots of different people and populations. And so I just liked it because it was a number that was validated in people that were not a hyper-specific athletic or not, you know, I'm 6 feet tall, not all 6 feet tall individuals. Right. Yeah. So it was sort of like, I didn't just come up with it on my own. It came from observational research. And so I do think it's very realistic for people to hit. Now, can somebody be healthy at 600 grams? Sure. It's just that when we fill up on fruits and veggies, we tend to not eat as much as the processed stuff.
Yeah.
So then our overall quantity, it's easier to get that right.
Yeah.
When we eat less of fruits and veggies, we're not as full. We tend then to eat more processed foods and it's way easier to overeat calories than in that scenario.
Right.
So that's why I feel like 800 is very doable, but certainly somebody can pull off that balance on a lower number.
Yeah, fair enough. I love that.
So that's kind of my main message is these 10 principles I've come up with. Like I love the 800 gram challenge, but my main message is the 10 principles to try to help people understand how is it possible to have all these different diets where people quote see results. And I think that's actually, I know I'm sort of on a rant here, but here we go.
No,
I think this is one of the ways the non-expert can evaluate health, health influencers or health teachers or health educators.
Mm-hmm.
It's if they're not explaining how all these different diets work, they're probably trying to sell you something.
Yeah,
like I'm going to tell you why carnivore can work. I don't love it for many reasons, but it can work. And I'm going to do the same for all the diets. And so I think that's a great way people can be like, are they selling me their one specific diet that they think they've like magically created? Or are they kind of giving me a baseline understanding and then presenting their bias and whatever it may be?
Yeah, fair enough. That's the marketing is a lot of times obnoxious and a little bit, as we all know, but I think having these different templates to work out at least gives people options. And like you said, it can be healthy and really depends on individual specificity and all that stuff and your personal preferences and tastes. And it's like, if we're all expected to do carnivore, we'd probably be doomed, or keto or whatever.
Right.
So you mentioned the 10th principle of nutrition, which I actually love. I think that's a great kind of template to work with. And I think it's an awesome starting point and at least gets people asking the right questions around their own nutrition. There's a couple I want to chat with you about.
Yeah.
You say timing only matters to the extent that it affects quantity. And and I think there's definitely validity to that. So there's been quite a bit of research. I guess I feel like the research is a little bit spread around timing around workouts with nutrition. Mm-hmm. What's your take on that in terms of like, is it just kind of experimentation? Is it somewhat you're calling fallen statistics for kind of pre and post workout nutrition?
Yeah. So what happens a lot of times in these studies, timing is confounded with quantity. Mm-hmm. So let's say they're doing these studies and they're seeing whether or not a post workout protein shake adds lean mass. Okay, great. So they've got the two groups. They give one group a protein shake. They don't give the other group a protein shake and they see what happens. And then guess what? The group that had the protein shake after the workout ends up adding more lean mass.
Wild, the group, wild concept.
Right. Well, the group that didn't get the protein shake is now missing out on 30, 40 grams of protein a day. Mm-hmm. Now, one conclusion people incorrectly draw is, well, that's a timing study. You have to have the protein shake after the workout. But when mm-hmm. we look at the absolute amount of protein that differed between the groups, the one that got the protein shake ends up being 30 to 40 grams more. Yeah. So when we equate the protein between the two groups, there's just not that many studies that do that because yeah. you have to give like a placebo that's not protein. So it would be like you give the non-protein group a carb drink. And so therefore it's not protein. And therefore we don't expect the lean mass. What yeah. they would have to do is they'd have to give the one group the protein shake right after the workout. And then they'd have the other group maybe do the protein shake before the bed.
Yeah.
And we don't have a ton of those studies. And when they do that, we don't really find a difference.
Right. Fair enough.
And so this is what gets really mixed up with quantity because timing and quantity get really mixed up because people in their day, and this is how I try to explain it to my clients as well. Like if having the protein shake after the workout helps you achieve your total quantity on the day, because that's the opportunity to have protein and you miss that window.
Yeah.
Maybe you've missed a chance to have 30 to 40 grams of protein.
Yeah.
Timing does matter to the extent it affects your total quantity.
Yeah.
But you could shift that protein shake anywhere in the day. And so far as we see, it will have the same effect.
Yeah. Fair enough. Cool. Another point I like is sustainability is the most important factor in diet selection. And I love this because the diet trends are always short-lived. They're like, let's just lose 20 pounds these next month and then go back to our old habits and gain it all back and go to that wedding or that trip or whatever.
Right.
But obviously, and people are so short-sighted. I think that's partly the marketing, partly people's kind of like response and social media, all these things are factoring in. To this point, do you feel like a stepwise solution to nutrition coaching is the solution to that as opposed to like, here's your sort of like, here's your diet you've got to follow kind of in, as a whole, or do you kind of lean towards a stepwise coaching?
I definitely do stepwise. I mean, I run a master class where I bring people through and we do three phases and it kind of comes in an order that I think increases complexity for sure. Mm-hmm. Sustainability is an interesting one. Like that is the principle. It is the most important factor in diet selection, but I would say all 10 principles are valid and equal in that. Maybe sustainable for you right now is cupcakes and Doritos. Well, if you want the weight change, we have to balance something that's sustainable with the fact that calories also matter. So it's like the degree of change has to be sustainable, but it's not just like, oh, this is what I can sustain right now. Cause obviously if nothing changes, nothing changes. But so generally what I find is it's sort of like, I don't want to say the maximum level of discomfort. It's almost like on a scale of 1 to 10, it's like, you want to figure out something that's like a 7 in terms of doability for somebody, right? Like it's not just something that they're enough. They're like, yeah, I can do it, but it's not something they're already completely knocking out of the park. There needs to be a little bit of a stretch there. Yeah. And so typically a stepwise helps with that because we just can't jump into all of the changes we need to do right away.
Yeah, no, I fully agree. Well said. And the other point I like is that your diet can't be validated. And I think like we can, even if we're doing blood work and, you know, the whole bit and we're like measuring our body weight, body composition or for performance, there's no way to say 100% it is diet. I think, is that the point you're making?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's also a little bit of this health anxiety people tend to have. They want to know if everything that they're doing is okay.
Right.
We certainly can tell you where we see risk is minimized, but we can't tell you at an individual level or guarantee health. You know, we know on a population level that keeping a healthy weight, that exercising, eating lots of fruits and vegetables is the way to, not smoking, you know, is the way to minimize your risk.
Yeah.
But we find plenty of times people do that and they still get a disease that we can't explain.
Yeah.
And so it's just a little bit to be like, hey guys, this is the best we can do. We can look at your current health markers. We can look at your weight. We can look at your current performance and that's all we can do.
Yeah.
And I find that it ends up helping people a little bit because I think there's so much in this optimum wellness space, especially for my type A CrossFitter type. Yeah, of chasing this optimum where they keep getting all these tests, they keep doing all this supplementation and it's like, nothing's wrong with them. Now we're in the abyss of the unknown, but that's just for everybody.
Right.
Fair enough. That's what it is. It's like kind of, we can get to a certain point at which we know we've minimized risk and then you're done. And then we just, you know, genetics are at play, lifetime exposure is at play.
Yeah.
And that's all you can do.
Yeah. I love that. So to that note, obviously we do want to measure to some extent. What are your kind of default outcome measures? Obviously, like maybe it's related to the specific goals of the person, but if someone's kind of like, what should I be following to know if my diet's helping? Mm-hmm. Is it body weight composition? Is it maybe sleep? Like, what are your kind of default outcome measures you like people to follow?
I do like weight and body composition, partially because they're relatively easy and convenient.
Yeah.
But one of the things is like, we get a better picture with more markers. You know, people will get wrapped around the axle about weight and it's like, okay, well, that doesn't tell us everything. So yeah, weight, body composition help. I do like just a general health panel from the doctor. So, you know, basic comprehensive metabolic panel, a cholesterol, fasting glucose, HbA1c, that type of stuff. Doesn't have to be everything, but that's good. And then I do like a fitness marker. This doesn't mean that we all have to be, you know, going to whatever the stage of the CrossFit Games is, but
there's you know, Fran every 3 weeks.
Right. We don't have to know be in the top echelon there.
Yeah.
But I do think that having some basic fitness capacity is a useful marker as well. And we want to see that all of them are maintaining or improving over time.
Yeah. I love that. Awesome. I want to shift into a little bit of protein because that's the one metric that isn't really considered in the 18 grams of challenge. And I think to your point, I think like, you know, once you've got that 800 grams, you're not going to reach for that kind of processed stuff. And I think you're going to get high, hopefully quality stuff. There's some data that maybe shows there's an upper limit on protein. There's like, and I think it depends on your activity level and health, individuality, all this stuff. Where does your opinion and take on protein numbers lie? How do you navigate people choosing how much protein is right for them?
Yeah. So that's kind of the second phase of my diet. Definitely my CrossFitter group was like, EC, what about protein? I mean, fruits and veggies, come on, great. Now what about protein?
Yeah.
So that's kind of step two for me. I call it lazy macros. Now, in addition to hitting 800 grams of fruits and vegetables, you're going to hit a protein target. Mm-hmm. I set a baseline just like the 800 gram challenge. My baseline for protein for people is 0.7 grams per pound of body weight.
Okay.
Which tends to be a little bit lower than some others in the functional fitness space or even the bodybuilding space. I do say people can go up to 1 gram per pound of body weight. Mm-hmm. But I find that the 0.7 number falls in line with research that is good for weight, health, and performance goals. And that's always how I look at everything. So from a weight perspective, it's where you can maintain muscle mass when a caloric deficit. Mm-hmm. From a health perspective, it's higher than where we see people can be protective of sarcopenia, the natural loss of muscle mass as we age. And from a performance perspective, it's where they found that like kind of recreational trainees were able to maximize muscle mass addition. So it's like, for me, it's a number that made sense in terms of quote, the science.
Yeah.
But then more importantly, perhaps I found it was a number that was sustainable.
Yeah.
You know, I have done the 1 gram of pound, 1 gram per pound myself. And again, I'm 6 feet tall. So 180 grams of protein a day is like, I can do it
after a while. Yeah.
But I mean, like I like protein powder. I'm not against protein powder, but just every day, you know, it's just sort of like, oh my God, I have to always have this.
Yeah.
And so I think there's a little bit of that too, that we forget that how much protein we need, you already said it, depends on our activity and our volume and intensity. Like you need to necessitate that type of volume of protein. Are there people out there in the bodybuilding space who need it or the high level CrossFitters who need it? Yes, of course. It's not the 99%.
I agree.
You know? And so I think we can get our gains. We can improve our body composition. We can be lean. We can be healthy at a lower and what I consider a more sustainable number.
Yeah. I like the idea of how your kind of training is periodizing your nutrition with it. So if you're focusing a little more on strength, maybe you beef up the protein a little bit here and there.
Sure.
So you're not like ever reaching kind of toxic levels or whatever and kind of hitting the reset. It's a way to mix things up. So you're not eating 200 grams of protein every day for the rest of your
every
life
day.
Too. Yeah.
It's just hard. I mean, I've said this kind of as an upper guideline and I don't like to be held to certain numbers, but when we're talking Gen Pop or, and not even just Gen Pop, even CrossFitters that are like to do it, but you know, again, aren't going to a competitive level. Yeah. Sustaining over 150 grams of protein a day is hard.
Yeah.
I mean, for people to do that, they're really into fitness. They really, that's their priority. Right.
Yeah.
And so some of these multipliers I'll see and they're like, I'm doing 175. And I'm like, okay, you know, report back in a few weeks when you're sick of it.
Yeah. Fair enough. I love that. Cool. So let's chat a little bit about carnivore. I read the book and actually read it right around this. Have you read How Not to Die by Michael Greger?
I have.
So it's just, that's fascinating.
They're
two
opposite.
MDs.
Right.
Same. You are both US trained medical physicians, both exact same education, both citing scientific papers throughout the book. both saying the complete opposite things, which is just like, if you ever want to send your head spinning, read those right back to back, which is, which is wild. And you see them attacking each other in social media and stuff like this. And I think it's kind of, it's just entertaining. So a couple of things he talks about, that there is an upper limit of, you know, how much vegetables we should get in. There's toxicity in vegetables. And if you actually, and you probably did this too, if you actually go up and look up the original papers, it doesn't necessarily jive completely with the points he's making at times. Do you think there is an upper limit? Is there some validity that that the vegetables have developed these kind of defense mechanisms that they don't want, quote unquote, want to be eaten? Is this something that most people should be wary of, or are we kind of, are you still of the thought that you can't overdo fruits and veggies in general?
You can't overdo fruits and veggies, largely because you're just going to be full before anything happens on a caloric perspective. Potentially you could overdo it on a fiber perspective and you would know from GI distress, but it's not something that, like, oh my gosh, we've harmed ourselves forever. But this idea that we're going to be, you know, anything can become toxic, but what happens on fruits and veggies, you're physically too full to actually reach a toxicity level of it. I mean, there's, you know, cyanide and almonds, but no one's like freaking out about that, right?
Yeah.
And there's toxic stuff all around us. It's always a matter of dose, and the dose that we're getting from fruits and vegetables is not it. And you hit the nail on the head. That's the problem with so many of these books. I mean, I just did a review of Plant Paradox. I've done a review of Carnivore Code. When you go to look at the studies that they cite, they're completely irrelevant for why they're citing them. And one of them in specific that I'll bring up about the Carnivore Code that drives me crazy, he cites papers by Bruce Ames. Bruce Ames is a famous biochemist who developed the Ames test to test chemicals for carcinogenicity as well as mutagens. So knows what he's talking about in terms of cancer. And this whole paper is going through exposures to pesticides and stuff like that. And basically Bruce's Ames conclusion is that one of the best ways that we know to prevent cancer is to eat fruits and vegetables. That's in the paper. And the carnivore guy cites it to say that plants are toxic.
It's wild.
You cannot, I mean, like, I get it. Maybe you have your ideas about what your opinion is, but you can't take an opinion where the whole paper, the whole thing, the guy's belief is to eat more fruits and vegetables, and you're using it to say that people shouldn't eat fruits and vegetables. That's cherry picking.
Absolutely.
And it's completely, I just think it's an incredible disservice to people. I mean, I know people send me his clips all the time. I don't follow him. I don't watch them, but it's like, he's going on this tirade about broccoli apparently in this, in the supermarket. I mean, give me a break. You really think that's the issue for people in the American diet? I mean, give me a break.
It's been researched like to death, and there's like, and it like, the theory is that it's, you know, in high doses it's toxic, but like the you know, the writing's on the wall. It's been studied for 60 years. There's like all these health benefits. Are all those papers wrong? It's just, it's wild when you
This is what's confusing is, again, anything can be toxic in enough doses. So if you want to take an animal and you want to overfeed it a specific compound, you can create toxic
enough.
And this is how we test toxicity. And this is how we determine safe limits of things. We do overfeed animals to determine at which point it becomes toxic. So we know what's an exposure we can have, which is not toxic.
Right.
And so this is what happens is people will cite these toxicity studies and be like, oh my gosh, it kills animals. And it's like, no, that was the point of the study to figure out at which point it will be toxic. We know it will be at when will it be? And so this is what gets mixed up in all this stuff. Dose, dose, dose. Believe me, if broccoli was an issue, we would know by now.
I agree. I mean, a couple things I did like in the book, and I think like he talks about causation is not correlation. I think that's an important point. And I think that's like, it's, it makes nutrition super difficult to analyze, right? And I think meat tends to get a bad rap because a lot of times it's correlative studies where you're studying these populations of meat eaters and comparing them to non-meat eaters. And there's all these other lifestyle factors that fit in, and there's no way to eliminate all of them. So I appreciate that. And to me, like the most beneficial thing is that I feel like I'm not going to die eating my steaks. It's like, so, and even though the, you know, the WHO had these correlative studies and stuff like this, I don't, to me and my own research, I'm comfortable that knowing there's just no definitive link of like meat and carcinogen, like cancer and stuff like that. Is that kind of where your line of thinking as well?
Yeah. I mean, I eat meat. And I'm not afraid of it from that perspective. And I do think there's a lot of confounding factors. And that is a great point. The correlation is not causation. I mean, just because, again, I think his science is so shaky, he makes that point and that's correct. But then he goes on later in the book to cite correlative studies in his favor and against, you know, like he'll be like, oh my gosh, their point is so bad because they cited these correlation studies. But then when he needs to, he'll also cite correlation studies. Yeah. And so it's, again, it's just a little bit too much cherry picking for me to be able to support his conclusions. But I agree, the general concept there of correlation does not equal causation is accurate.
And I think that throws a lot of people off. It's just like you hear the headline and not read the paper, understand the science. It's just kind of throws people off.
But, well, and this is the other thing too, that we have to remember, there is no way for us to test long-term diet control studies. We don't want to live in the Truman Show. Nobody's willing to write their life off to have every aspect of their diet analyzed and controlled. So what we have to do are these observation studies over the 20-year period. Right. Sure, we can do randomized controlled trials maybe up to a year or whatever. Yeah. But if we really want to be able to say what happens in the long term, it's going to be these observational studies because we can't logistically do controlled studies on people's entire life.
Yeah. And we can't, and there's only so much we can get from mice and rats. And
exactly. So it's, you kind of have to put all of the pieces together, right? Like we do like the correlative studies, but if they're a really weak correlation and it kind of is yes and no, and the results always change, it's less of great evidence.
Yeah.
It's when we see the same thing over and over again in a correlation, when we see the same thing in a randomized controlled trial, and then we also understand it mechanistically from the rice or the cell stuff. Mm-hmm. That's when we start to be like, okay, this is what's going on here. We can't just pick one or two and think that we have the answer.
Yeah, I agree. Well said. Cool. So let's shift into the opposite end of the spectrum in terms of like not what's harmful for us, but the superfoods. And I think that's maybe a bit of the marketing overused term. People kind of get lumped into that. But the quote unquote superfoods, what are some of the ones that are under the radar for you that you feel like most people aren't getting enough of?
Fruits and vegetables, full stop, you know, that whole food protein sources, maybe nuts, maybe some whole grains, but no specific food. And that's something that I really kind of refuse to pigeonhole myself into, that people need more of, you know, blueberries or salmon or something like that. Because I think that's part of the problem. We get so fixated on this one answer when in reality, these whole foods are all mixtures of nutrients, and it's the collection across our day that puts the good picture together.
Yeah.
You know, and even from a sustainability perspective, let's say that blueberries were the best thing ever. I mean, after about 10 days straight of them, you're going to want something else. Mm-hmm. So it's like, okay, I mean, they're healthy, but we can get those nutrients from other things and eat them. Yes, include them, but we can do fine without them as well. And so I just don't like to give people these short lists because I find that we A, don't need them, and B, just over long term, it's just not realistic.
Yeah, fair enough. Lets people kind of like follow their tastes and preferences and keep that variety going too. I love that.
Totally, totally.
Yeah, fair enough. So I want to shift into EC's kind of personal habits, and I think as coaches, I'm a bit of a mad scientist myself with this stuff, and it's easy to rabbit hole and gets kind of dragged all over the place with this stuff. What is at the top of your list of health and fitness priorities right now, and what do your habits look like around that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's on brand just to sort of say consistency, specifically with the kind of 800 gram challenge approach and lazy macros. That is what I do every day. I make sure I have 800 grams of fruits and veggies. I make sure I hit a baseline level of protein. That's what I pay attention to. I do that. Yeah. I wouldn't say 100% of days, but it's about 90% of days a year.
Nice.
And then, I'm pretty darn consistent with fitness too. Mm-hmm. You know, certainly life has changed as you get older. I'm sure you find priorities change a little bit versus just spending all the hours in the gym.
Yeah.
But you still fit it in somehow, you know, even if it's just a 15-minute quick workout. So, so those probably have always been my priorities, and they continue to be. I would say I'm not doing much of meddling on anything. Like, I'm just sort of keeping them on autopilot.
Fair enough. Cool. Amazing. Well, you see, this has been an awesome chat. What's the best place for people to learn more from you?
Yeah. Just on social media, Optimize Me Nutrition, optimizemenutrition.com is the website. And then the podcast is The Consistency Project.
Amazing. Well, appreciate the time. It was an awesome chat.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks for tuning in this episode of Healthspan Academy, guys. And we'll see you next time. Hey, what's up, guys? Thanks for tuning in today. Hope you enjoyed the episode. Thank you so much for supporting this channel. This has been a fun project. We're growing in viewership every single week, and we obviously couldn't do that without you. So thank you for continuing to tune in. I really hope you're getting value out of the programming and the content. Just wanted to give you a heads up. I've been working on a book on health and longevity the last couple of years. Been collaborating with my colleague, Dr. Dan Vitale, who's an expert in the field as well. And we've basically just kind of summarized the literature, some of the techniques that we found really useful in the world of biohacking, what our exercise regimen looks like, what's, you know, cardio type stuff is going to help us live longer and healthier, mobility work, nutrition. We've covered the whole spectrum, everything that you can basically be in control of in your health and fitness kind of moving forward to help you live as healthily as possible for as long as possible. And it's available free for download. So if you click on the YouTube banner, you'll see a link to download the blueprint. It's also on our Instagram profile or on the website. You can click on fivepillarmethod.com/optimize to get your free copy of the book. And I hope you enjoy it. Hope you're keeping well. Thanks again for tuning in, and we'll see you next time.